Now, my attempt to avoid freeway delays took me on a neighborhood tour that was entertaining, but I sincerely apologize for the delay.
I was just going to say we apologize for the unanticipated delay and not identify who was late. But
I'm fessing up.
You did. All right. The first case on the calendar is Ortiz-Tiriana.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Dana Nelson on behalf of Max Ortiz-Tiriana. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of rebuttal, please. The issue in this case is whether the court's consent instruction violated Max Ortiz-Triana's due process right to have the state prove all the elements of the offense.
And WR resolved that.
Okay, Your Honor.
And I think they resolved it in your favor.
Okay, excellent.
Well, I mean, I don't think you can read that opinion and not come to that conclusion.
Right. So I guess the question that the court is interested in is the harmless error analysis.
Well, and I know the state made two arguments. Invited error, and I'm not precluding you from addressing that, but there's invited error and there's harmless error. And I'd also like to note that I understand that Spicer is applying a different standard. It's a habeas standard, which is different than harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But the question was, could there ever be a case where you had harmless error in light of the WR decision? I guess that's really one question I've got. And I know from the record, and this isn't the first time we've had this case here, that unless the state takes a different position, I think the facts are similar to WR. This was a jury trial, not a bench trial, as in WR, but you had consent at issue and you had the defendant testify.
That's true, Your Honor. And as Your Honor mentioned, the Spicer court looked at some things in resolving their harmless error analysis that the state is actually arguing in this case. So although obviously it is a different standard because it's a habeas case,
right.
I can see the somewhat of the symmetry. But again, because of the distinction between the procedural posture of court, the state here has to prove that it was harmless. And I think Your Honor asked.
I mean, if you look at the, certainly our Supreme Court before WR, and they have not changed this, has taken the position that the state can show that an instruction that misstates an element is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So the question is, do we have that here? And so I guess you should answer that, and then you should talk about Spicer.
Okay. Your Honor, I would say no, we don't have that here. One of the reasons we don't have that here is because the jury did not find this complainant altogether credible because it acquitted Max Ortiz-Triana of the higher degree offense, which she described in her testimony, and also acquitted him of the molestation charge, which she described in her testimony, too. So there was some question regarding this complainant's credibility. And Your Honor asked if there ever could be a case where the state could prove harmlessness. You know, I don't know the answer to that question, certainly, but I would say it's not this case. Because Max Ortiz-Triana did put on evidence of consent, and the jury disbelieved the complainant to a certain extent. And it was argued to the jury, and the instruction, although defense counsel argued the correct legal standard, without that instruction and with the instruction to the jury that counsel's remarks are not the law, the law is contained in the instructions, the consent instruction was still in there, requiring jurors to find that the defendant proved it by a preponderance. And as defense counsel argued, it's possible that jurors could have thought that they could not even consider consent unless it rose to that level.
Well, as I understand it, the jury instruction the defense proposed also included, and I understand why, but it also included the same language that the WIPIC had based on Kamara and Gregory.
That's true, Your Honor, but it also contained clarifying language that even if the jury didn't find that it rose to that preponderance standard, that it could still consider it on the issue of forcible compulsion. And it expressly stated that if the jury found that it rose to a sufficient level to create a reasonable doubt, that it must acquit. So that's completely in line with W.R. and does away with any misunderstanding by the requiring the defendant to have that high bar of proof.
Could we view the split jury verdict as actually she was credible, but the state simply didn't put on enough proof because they did convict of one of the offenses?
Your Honor, they did convict him on one of the offenses, but I don't know if we can really speculate as to what the jury was thinking. I think
that's true of the statement you just made.
Right, but it's the state's burden to prove that this instruction had no effect, not Max Ortiz Triana's burden. Prejudice is presumed here unless the state can prove otherwise, and I think under these facts, the state cannot prove otherwise. The fact that Ortiz Triana put on evidence, the fact that the jury did not find the complainant entirely credible, those go against a finding of harmlessness. And
so if we had different facts, I mean, let's set the facts of this case aside. If we had the Spicer facts, so if we looked at the facts in Spicer, which was evidence, obviously, I mean, they don't say much, but it looks as though there was a consent defense and there was testimony as to consent, but it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, but not beyond a reasonable doubt in their habeas analysis.
Right, Your Honor.
But harmless because there was evidence, physical evidence, of duct tape, of bruising on the victim. So if we had a case like that, the question, I mean, it's just out of curiosity, but also something that needs to be answered in the context of trying to define the parameters of WR. So could you have a case where there's harmless beyond the reasonable doubt if you have the facts in Spicer?
I think so, Your Honor. I mean, under the Nieder v. United States, if the court can find that leaving a whole element out can be harmless error, I would think that there could be a certain case where the facts would be such that
even if they didn't have the right instructions, the evidence was so overwhelming.
I wouldn't want to try and imagine what that case is, but I think Your Honor brought up some important facts about the physical evidence mm-hmm. in the Spicer case, which we didn't have here because it wasn't reported for some time.
Right.
And there was also evidence put on that the complainant here might have made this up because she feared she was pregnant and some other facts that went into the mix.
So you're asking, well, I'll ask you on
okay.
3 minutes what you're asking for. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. Deborah Dwyer representing the respondent, the state of Washington. We're asking this court to affirm the defendant's conviction for second-degree forcible rape for two reasons. First, the error was invited, and secondly, the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, I know that the defense relies on Fields in arguing against applying invited error here, but I believe the situation in Fields is distinguishable from this one, and this court should apply the invited error doctrine. Secondly, as to harmless error, I believe we do have harmless error here, based on the fact that the court did correctly instruct the jury on the state's burden of proof as to forcible compulsion. There was independent evidence of forcible compulsion, both with the knife and with the victim's actions in the aftermath of the rape. I'll start with the harmless error, but I would like to get to the invited error.
Well, you can start with invited error.
All right,
if you want. And you know, looking at WR, I mean, obviously before WR, no one thought that there was anything other than Camara and Gregory, right? And so if you look at the decision in WR, the court is talking about the problem that's created by using the wrong legal framework and how that then creates an issue. But here you have defense counsel who who relied on Kamara and Gregory.
Right. But
so how can that be invited error? I mean, you know, the prosecutor did too, and so did the court.
But the defense attorneys in the Stud case, Fields was one part of the Stud case, but the attorneys in the Stud case relied on standard WIPEX to propose an instruction that, on self-defense, that the court later found was incorrect, but the court nevertheless implied the invited error doctrine. Our Supreme Court's been very strict with the invited error doctrine. They say it's invited error if you propose it, and it's not ineffective assistance of counsel if that's what the WIPIC or the case law supported at the time. So I think this is a very standard invited error case, but for the fact that defense counsel in this case proposed what he said was some clarifying language.
Right.
But this is different from Fields, where the court declined to apply invited error. In Fields, the defense attorney proposed the erroneous self-defense instruction, which made it seem like actual imminent danger was necessary. But the defense attorney also proposed another WIPIC, the mistaken belief instruction, which told the jury, you don't have to have actual danger, just the belief. In Fields, if the court had given the second instruction, the mistaken belief instruction, that error would have been cured. There wouldn't have been any problem with the instructions. That's not the case here. What the defense attorney proposed here, as the trial court found, was really not different from what the instructions already said. The instructions already told the jurors that they could consider, in fact, they should consider all of the evidence, and if after considering all of the evidence, they had a reasonable doubt as to any of the elements, they had a duty to find the defendant not guilty. So the clarification was already there. What the defense attorney was proposing wouldn't have taken away the error that he also invited, which was placing a separate burden on the defendant to prove consent by a preponderance of the evidence. If you look at WR, I think the court was clear there in footnote 3 that the standard instructions are completely adequate to tell jurors where burden of proof is.
But they're not talking about the consent instruction.
No, but what they were...
They separately address that, give one anymore.
Right. They said don't give one anymore, and that's the only error in this case, was giving it, which the defense invited. What WR said was you don't need any other instructions on consent. The standard instructions are fine, and that's what they said in footnote 3.
But here, nobody knew that. Then.
That's correct.
So if we look at Stud, in that situation, I think the court said that it would not apply invited error if there was an erroneous instruction, but the proposed instruction also tried to remedy the error. And your argument here is that the instruction the defense proposed did not seek to remedy the error?
Well, it wouldn't have remedied the error. In Stud or in Fields, one of the cases in Stud, it would have remedied the error. Here it wouldn't have. You still would have had, even if you told the jury in defense counsel's words what the instructions already said, that they could consider all of the evidence in deciding whether the defendant was guilty of every element of the crime, even if that had been given, you'd still have that error of placing a burden by a preponderance on the defendant.
But before WR, there was an unambiguous mandate.
That's
from
correct.
The Supreme Court that said that the defendant had the burden by a preponderance to prove this. So in that situation, you think even with that unambiguous mandate, that the invited error doctrine should apply?
Understood. I believe our Supreme Court would apply the invited error doctrine in that situation.
Okay, now we better move on to harmless error.
I would like to address harmless error briefly, and I think there's two reasons why, or two supports for harmless error finding in this case. First of all, as we've already discussed, the jury was correctly instructed that the state bore the burden of proof on forcible compulsion. And secondly, there was quite a bit of corroborating evidence for the victim here. First of all,
WR would say that the jury was not incorrectly instructed because the jury was also instructed on consent.
Right, but what W.R. said was, and this is on page 770 of W.R., the trial court's express conclusion was that W.R. did not prove consent. They put that in their harmless error analysis.
Yes, they did.
And they relied on that. Here, the state never argued the consent, that the consent was on the defendant. Burden of proof was on the defendant. When the defense attorney mentioned it, he mentioned that the instructions tell you you're supposed to consider all of the evidence and it's the state's burden to prove forcible compulsion. So I think that distinguishes this from the situation in W.R. In addition, there was physical evidence of forcible compulsion. We have the knife. Now, counsel argues, well, the jury didn't believe the victim about the knife. I don't think there's any reason to conclude that. It's just that the definition of a deadly weapon for first-degree rape is fairly strict. You have to show that under the circumstances in which it was used, it was capable of causing serious bodily harm or death. The jury didn't have the knife. The knife was not in evidence. Nobody was sure exactly which knife it was, but the mother testified, when I came home from work the next morning, there was a knife on the counter that wasn't there the night before because I cleaned the kitchen. So the jury wouldn't have had any reason to doubt that, I don't think. The jury clearly believed the victim that there was forcible compulsion. They just couldn't find a deadly weapon under that strict definition without seeing the knife. The only description was it was short and silver. So they certainly never could have found that it was 3 inches on those facts or that it was necessarily would qualify as a deadly weapon. So in addition to that, though, you have the fact that the victim moves out of the house immediately, out of her mother's house and into her father's house. Her father said she completely changed. She was outgoing and talkative. She was suddenly withdrawn. In the weeks following the rape, she gets suspended from school twice for fighting and for alcohol. She told a very close friend, and he said she was shaking uncontrollably and crying when she told him shortly after the rape what had happened. So we've got a lot of evidence here of forcible compulsion. And I think if you combine that with the fact that there's no evidence like there was in W.R. that the fact finder explicitly relied on that burden of proof and that the fact finder was told to consider all of the evidence, I think you can find it harmless. And again, I would just urge the court to seriously consider the invited error. Applying the invited error doctrine as well. I think Studd supports it, and I think this is a different situation than Fields. What defense counsel was proposing would not have cured the error that he himself invited the court to make by proposing that. He didn't just agree to, you know, the instruction on consent as an affirmative defense. He proposed it.
So Studd is the main case you're relying on for?
I believe it is the case.
The invited error.
The ones in Studd that they where they did apply invited error, not Fields.
All right. Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to address the invited error argument as well as the forcible compulsion instruction. This case is exactly like Fields. The defense counsel proposed that portion of the instruction, which we now know is incorrect, but he also proposed language that is correct that says it's still the state's burden to prove forcible compulsion, and if you find the defense has raised substantial evidence or sufficient evidence of consent to raise a reasonable doubt, you must acquit. That is a correct statement of the law. Had defense counsel merely offered the WIPIC without this clarifying language, then yes, we would have invited error. But we don't have that here. So this is exactly like Fields. Going to the forcible compulsion instruction, in W.R., the trial judge there, who was the fact finder, made a specific finding that the state proved second-degree rape by forcible compulsion. So I think that what can be inferred from that is a fact finder's finding of forcible compulsion does not necessarily mean that allocating the burden to the defense to prove consent necessarily has no impact on the case, that therefore the state is able to prove harmlessness. Because if that was the case, then the Supreme Court wouldn't have reversed in that case.
Well, what the Supreme Court said is that because the state argued that the court should defer to the credibility determination of the finder of fact. The court said that it was impossible to tell how that credibility determination would have been made because the incorrect legal framework was used.
And that's true here, too. It's actually doubly so because in that case, there was a judge who was the fact finder who presumably is versed in the overlap between consent and forcible compulsion. So if they're going to reverse in that case, it seems even more prejudicial here where we have a jury who might not understand that overlap and is specifically told they have to prove, this defense has to prove consent.
Well, I mean, based on WUR, I don't think there's any overlap.
Well, there was overlap in the instructions in this case.
Yes, there was, because that's how Camaro and Gregory described it. But I think WUR has made it clear there is no overlap.
Correct. And had the court given the instruction as proposed by defense counsel, we wouldn't have a problem here. But the court didn't. And so the instructions...
Well, I don't know if we would have a problem here in the context of WUR, but that's a different question. So you are asking us to reverse.
That's correct. Reverse Max Ortiz Triana's conviction. It's a due process violation. So, you know, the state would be able to retry him based on, you know, correct jury instructions and whatnot. But he didn't get a fair trial because the state wasn't held to its burden to prove all the elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next case is...